The time is approximately 1:45. The date is March 27th, Tuesday, 1984. The place is the Judiciary Hearing Room, Room 124, located within the Capitol Building at Juneau, Alaska. Scheduled matters of interest before the committee today are Senate Bill 453, an act relating to the Commission of Judicial Conduct and providing for an effective date, and House Bill 698, an act relating to marijuana and providing an effective date. Present for the scheduled matters hearing today, representing Barnes, representing Liska, representing Hayes, and myself, representing Russell. As a first matter to be dealt with today, I'd like to take up a matter that we've heard before and had produced the agreed to substitute. House Bill Substitute for Senate Bill 453. And Mike Holmes is here for the sponsor to make a statement. No, we're going to pass this. Mike, at this time, if you care to make some brief remarks to the committee, I'd appreciate it. Since we are recording electronically so that I can identify your voice, I need you to state your name for the record prior to your comments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Holmes. I'm the chairman of the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Senate Bill 453 is a bill requested by the Commission. It's basically a housekeeping bill that was drafted to bring the state statutes into conformance with the constitutional amendments that were passed by the voters in November of 1982. As you know, the amendment at that time changed the name of the commission and also changed the composition. Mr. Chairman, I can go through the bill section by section,
Mike, I don't think we need that. We had a real problem today in timing. We've been caught in a caucus, and I have another timing problem at least two of the committee members are away from the meeting now, and then at 2 o'clock we have a national kind of a hookup thing coming, so Representative Barnes?
Mr. Chairman, it be your desire to entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that House CS Senate Bill Number 453, Judiciary, an act relating to the Commission on Judicial Conduct and providing for an effective date, be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Is there objection? Hearing none, House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 453 is now before the committee. Representative Barnes?
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that House CS Senate Bill Number 453, Judiciary, an act relating to the Commission on Judicial Conduct and providing for an effective date, be moved from the committee.
Is there objection? There being none, House may substitute Senate Bill 453, Judiciary Move, was made today with individual recommendations. Thank you very much, Mr. Holmes.
Chairman.
The next scheduled matter before the committee is another reheard item. It's House Bill 698, an act relating to marijuana, provided for an effective date. Back up here. At 2 o'clock or in just a few moments, the committee is scheduled to dial up Dr. Reese T. Jones, who's a professor of psychiatry. Dr. Jones is a clinical psychiatrist at the University of California in San Francisco and has served as a member of the Distinguished Commission of Scholars sponsored by the Institute of Medicine to study the psychological and physiological effects of marijuana. The report entitled Marijuana and Health is recognized by the medical community as one of the preeminent academic works on the subject. At 2:30, or after listening to Dr. Reese and taking what questions committee members might have, we are scheduled to talk to, proper to call him, Dr. Gabriel Nohaz. Dr. Nohaz is from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Nohaz is a professor at Columbia University in New York and is renowned as a pioneer in research of biological effects of marijuana, considered by many as the foremost authority on the subject. Dr. Nohaz has authorized two books, Keep Off the Grass and Marijuana Biological Effects. An abundance of material here that's been gathered by the committee for anybody here that cares to take additional copies of it and might want to go through it. I'm presuming that Dr. Nohaz will at least discuss some of these statements that are contained in his book. Those of you here may want to get a copy of them. There's a copy at the door so you can follow along a little better. I wonder, Craig, if we called him a little bit early, I wonder if he'd be there. What was the deal? Did you tell him?
I told Dr. Jones I'd call him right before six, so I get more of the convenience of calling him.
Why don't you give me a number, I'll ring him. We had a thing here to broadcast just to Ketchikan. There were a number of people in Ketchikan that wanted to listen to this. What happened to that setup? It didn't work, or?
Well, since it evolved so lately, they weren't able to get the people there. So it's right here.
We'll take this.
Hello? Yes, Dr. Jones, please.
Dr. Jones?
Yes, Dr. Jones, this is Craig Lovell with the House Judiciary Committee in Juneau, Alaska. I know we're a few minutes early, but we would like to begin now if you were prepared.
Sure, that's all right. How is the connection? There's a little bit of an echo in my voice at this end that I can live with, if it's all right up there.
It's just perfect here, Doctor.
All right, then, so be it.
Doctor, I'm Charlie Bussell, and I'm chairman of the House Judiciary Committee in Juneau at this time. And at this time, we have before us a bill that we titled House Bill 698, which is an act relating to marijuana. I would hope that the staff has briefed you thoroughly on the status of that bill and what we're doing. There are representatives from the Department of Law, as well as committee members present, or some committee members anyway, present, and other legislators present to hear your presentation today. And as you will, sir, we would take your comments at this time. And I might want to tell you a little bit about the Alaska Legislature, how it works here. We do record electronically all committee hearings, so it is being electronically recorded, sir.
That's fine.
Okay.
Well, I'll proceed then, if it's all right. Let me preface what I say, that I first heard of this yesterday afternoon, and so I really wasn't in a situation because of some other commitments to prepare a nice formal reason written statement that I could read to you. So what I'm going to say is pretty much as it comes to mind.
Perhaps, sir, that'll end up being a better statement for us.
Probably. The other caveat is that I'm always reluctant to comment on legislation, particularly what might be very complicated legislation, without really having a chance to think about it and read the documents. Now, I was given sort of a verbal summary of some of the issues, but since I'm not speaking as an expert on legal controls and regulation, that may be less important here. I'm speaking to you as someone who's been involved with marijuana research and marijuana issues for some years. First off, let me warn you and warn your committee, be careful of experts of any sort, particularly experts in the marijuana field. I'm not sure what an expert really is, particularly in areas of psychopharmacology, and particularly in the very complicated issues that come up around cannabis. Passions seem to be more prevalent amongst marijuana protagonists and antagonists than with most other drugs that I've been involved in. And so when in doubt, try as best you can as you know, non-scientist, non-specialist, try to go to the primary sources of the facts that people tend to quote or the conclusions they quote. My background just to give you some perspective, is that since the late 60s, I've been here at the University of California in San Francisco. We just happened to be very close to the Haight-Ashbury district, which was in its heyday, an area where really marijuana and many other drugs got their start. My laboratory was one of the very earliest ones in the late 60s to actually start doing marijuana studies in human subjects, and in various ways we've continued those studies, since about 1969. So I'm speaking as a psychiatrist who's had fair contact over the years with drug users of various sorts, and as a psychiatrist researcher who has had the rare opportunity of, I suppose, giving marijuana under controlled conditions to literally hundreds of volunteer subjects in both hospitalized and outpatient laboratory experiments. I could save us all a lot of time, and what I've been specifically asked to comment on are the health-related issues of marijuana, and I will use the word cannabis, which is a sort of a broader term for marijuana-related substances. But I've been asked to comment on, I suppose, marijuana as a drug, to try to highlight some issues, perhaps some newly appreciated issues that have some relevance to health-related potential. It's some issues that might want to be considered in terms of regulatory schemes, etc. First off, the effects of marijuana on health are difficult, nigh impossible to summarize. And I'll go through some of the findings, some of the organ systems in the body that it affects, that I think you'll agree with me towards the end, that any summarization will lead to some distortions, but I'll do the best I can. I have in front of me on my desk three different documents that were prepared by review committees, expert review committees, within the last few years here in the United States and in Canada. One of them that I hope the committee, your committee, has access to is one called Marijuana and Health, prepared by the National Academy of Sciences in the United States. That document, which is about 200 pages long, is the best attempt of a large committee that met over a one-year time to try to assess just what is the health related potential of marijuana use, what adverse effects can be identified, etc. And I had the good fortune of serving on that committee. I was one of the few marijuana researchers. Most of the people on that committee were selected as experts, medical scientists in their area, that had no personal involvement with marijuana research, so to try to get an unbiased, objective assessment of the data. Well, that committee concluded, as did the other two committees that I'll come back to in a moment, and let me just read the conclusion. It's a very short one, which I agreed with at the time, and now 2 years later even more agree with. The scientific evidence published to date, this is 1981, indicates that marijuana has a broad range of psychological and biological effects, some of which, at least under certain conditions, are harmful to human health. Unfortunately, the available information does not tell us how serious this risk may be. Our major conclusion is that the little we know for certain about the effects of marijuana on health, and all that we have reason to suspect, justifies serious national concern. Of no less concern is the extent of our ignorance about many of the most basic and important questions about the drug. Our major recommendation is that there be a greatly intensified and more comprehensive program of research into the effects of marijuana on the health of the American people. That's the end of that quote. Now scientists, myself included, sometimes tend to be self-serving to the extent that we almost always say, well, we need more research, and give us more money. We haven't answered all the questions. But it was somewhat humbling to me that the group of 20 or so scientists who really at the beginning were not familiar with the situation with marijuana, all of whom all finally came to the same conclusion that we really don't know very much about this very, very complicated drug. The little bit that we do know about it is enough to say, look, there is potential for harm on a number of systems. Now, at the same time, and completely coincidentally, a completely separate committee was meeting in Toronto, Canada. This has issued an 800-page summary, barely summarizing the scientific literature on marijuana. I had the good fortune or misfortune of also serving on that particular committee. I was about the only person where there was any overlap between these two committees. And that report, which is entitled Cannabis and Health Hazards, it's a report from the Addiction Research Foundation in Toronto and the World Health Organization, who sponsored and financed the meeting. It consisted of a week-long session of rather intense discussion of working papers that had been prepared over the previous 6 months, summarizing various aspects of marijuana-related health issues. And I'll very briefly read the summary statement from that committee, which I think complements the one that I just wrote you from, read to you from our National Academy of Sciences. That what that committee concluded was that cannabis is clearly capable, and they emphasize the word capable, of causing adverse effects on health. That some of these effects have already been recognized clinically in heavy users, that others have been produced in experimental animals that do not necessarily occur in humans at dose levels that have been employed by voluntary users until now. There is a serious lack of systematic epidemiologic information about the incidence and prevalence of such effects in different parts of the world. The Canadian committee was unusual in that it had representatives from many areas of the world, India, the Far East, the Middle East, where cannabis use is very heavy, considered to be far more of a problem for public health people than it is than it was in the United States at that time. The Canadian report finishes by mentioning the American report, where at that point a preliminary draft was available, and said that any differences that the two committees found really were minor ones. That they agreed wholeheartedly with the United States Committee that there was the evidence supporting the strong possibility in many areas, the clear demonstration in some few areas of adverse health consequences. That's sort of a long opening introduction. In the statement, what I propose doing now, if it seems reasonable to you, is to go over some of the major considerations in a very, very summary sort of way, effects of marijuana on various organ systems, a few comments on the complexity of the pharmacology and chemistry of marijuana that makes for this state of affairs where experts agree there's going to be problems that they can't necessarily list each specific individual problem. Does this seem like a reasonable thing to do at this point for your group?
Very reasonable, sir. You're coming good and clear, and I think everyone in the room can hear you well.
All right. Okay, first off, and here I'm going to be sort of depending on some a relatively brief chapter I wrote about a year ago. It was published in 1983 in the Annual Review of Medicine. An attempt in about 10 book pages to summarize the 800 pages from the Canadian report and the 300 pages or so from the United States report. It's a chapter called Cannabis and Health. The most important consideration when trying to understand what marijuana does, what it doesn't do, and trying to understand why you get such confusing opinions from various sources, even reputable, very thorough, and relatively unbiased scientists will not always agree as to findings from one laboratory to another. This stems not many.
Yep, you're fine, sir. That's
I hear a beeping on this end, but okay.
Well,
where there is a lot of disagreement, quite often it stems from just the complexity of the chemistry, the complexity of the pharmacology. Marijuana is not a single drug. It's a plant. It contains 60 or more chemicals, many of which seem to be, biologically speaking, very active. Only a few of which have been studied enough to really understand its pharmacology. The one substance in marijuana called THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, accounts for most of the effects of marijuana. But there's a lot of suggestion from many laboratories that these other 50, 60 substances can interact with THC to produce all sorts of complex outcomes when one is researching with experimental animals. Even if THC was the only substance in marijuana that was of importance in trying to figure out its effects and consequences, even if we were lucky that were the case, and that's not the case, of course, it's more complicated, but the chemistry of THC is about as complicated as any drug I can imagine. It's as complicated as any drug that I've worked with, and my lab works with LSD and cocaine and tobacco and a lot of fairly complicated drugs. The problem with THC is that it goes into fat, it goes into body tissues very, very rapidly. It's called lipophilic, simply meaning it likes to go into fat. And the brain is largely made up of fat. A lot of other organs have a lot of fat in them. So that when you put some THC into the body of an animal or smoking a cigarette, it quickly disappears from blood. And this has all sorts of complications in itself, in that you can measure blood levels in a marijuana user, and it doesn't necessarily tell you how much marijuana is in their brain. The blood level disappears very rapidly, more rapidly than most other drugs, not because the THC is broken down, metabolized, but more because it's binding to the fat, to the protein in the body, and disappearing from blood. Even now, after 20 years of research, we still don't know exactly how much goes into brain in animals or in humans, but a fair amount does go into brain, and that's what you're really interested in trying to judge when one is trying to predict certain psychoactive drug effects. And it's not like alcohol, where alcohol is so water-soluble that if you measure alcohol in the blood or if you measure alcohol in the urine, you can pretty much tell how much alcohol is in the brain. Marijuana can never be that simple. So, you know, issues like what blood level or urine level of marijuana might predict what level of driving impairment, these have not been worked out yet, and for theoretical reasons aren't likely to ever be very predictable. That is, you could measure a urine level or a brain blood level of marijuana and predict the level of behavioral impairment. The chemistry just doesn't fit that. Now, when it disappears from blood, it goes into these other tissues, and it's broken down into many, many, many breakdown products, whole dozens of them. Chemists like to make up lists of how many. I've seen a list including as many as 70, and so in theory. These breakdown products stay in the body for a long, long time. Whatever the level is, it takes about 70 or 80 hours for half that level to the level to drop to one half of the existing level. That's the so-called half-life. The point is that even after someone takes just one marijuana cigarette, you'll find these metabolites in the urine where they're slowly coming out. You'll find them in the blood at very low levels for weeks afterwards. Now, if you're an optimist and feel that marijuana has no long-term bad consequences, that's fine. If, like many scientists, you have, say, some test tube data or some animal data saying that marijuana does alter the immune system or chromosomes, what have you, here you have a situation where these very low levels of metabolites that no one has really studied, nobody understands exactly how active these are biologically, but you know for sure they're sitting around for long periods of time. Now, this may or may not be of any great consequence. The more conservative scientists on both of the Canadian and the U.S. committees that I referred to a little while ago, the conservative scientists said, look, we can't ignore this situation, that here you have these possibly biologically active things sitting there for days and days and days after only one exposure to marijuana. If someone's smoking a joint or two a day, which doesn't sound like much, it will keep you intoxicated for 3 or 4 hours, that person would be accumulating, would be building up very high levels of these metabolites over time. Now, the optimists say, well, there's no evidence these are harmful. The pessimists say things like amotivation and things like chronic memory impairment and the sort of behaviors that some people see in some young marijuana users, this is a direct consequence of these metabolites. The problem is that it's going to take years to unravel this. You can't imagine a more complicated situation for someone who's trying to understand the biological effects of these. I'll soon get off the pharmacology and get into the effects in a moment. One other complicated and misunderstood issue is that around the issue of tolerance to many of the marijuana effects, for mechanisms that we don't fully understand, in a situation where someone is using marijuana frequently, getting high doses frequently, what I mean by a high dose is 2 or 3 cigarettes a day, if it's potent material, perhaps one marijuana cigarette a day may be enough. Tolerance develops. That is, their systems, the brain, the other organs, adapt to the presence of the drug, and you see less drug effects. Now, one might say, well, that's a good situation, and won't you have fewer health consequences because of that? Well, the problem is that the mechanisms in the body that make for tolerance developing to a drug, that is, these things that adapt, sometimes are the very mechanisms that cause other problems. That is, in the body's attempt to adjust to the presence of a drug, it changes various chemical systems, etc., that can have such effects as when the drug is taken away, these mechanisms that counteracted the effects of the drug, say, keep people from getting as high on marijuana as they might otherwise be, suddenly then you see irritability, you see sleep loss, you see appetite disturbances, you see restlessness. This is something one expects from most drugs. For many years it was said, well, marijuana was a special sort of drug, that you could use it, nothing much happened, and you could use it regularly, and nothing much happened in terms of these adaptive mechanisms. But this is it's not surprising that was wrong. It's just that you have to use rather careful studies to demonstrate it. We demonstrated it some years ago, back in the mid-70s, that if you put people on a very controlled hospital environment, gave them substantial doses of marijuana, and then took it away, they became restless and irritable and angry and difficult to deal with. They were very pleasant people when they were getting the marijuana. They were very unpleasant people for a few days when you took it away. Well, at that time, that was sort of a laboratory curiosity. Some people thought it was important, others didn't. But now, in recent years, I continually are encountering colleagues who are treating marijuana users. And what are they treating them for? Well, these are people who come into clinics, sort of forced in usually, or encouraged to come in by friends, family, employers, whose family or employers feel they're not functioning very well, they're not thinking very well, they've lost their energy, their drive, their creativity. When they stop using the marijuana, they become irritable, they become restless, they have difficulty focusing on their tasks, and so on. It's precisely what you would expect with a drug that produces tolerance. It's precisely what you would expect when you take the drug away. One issue is, why don't you see this more clearly out in the real world? Why do you see it in the laboratory? Well, one explanation is if you drink some alcohol, some beer or wine will relieve these symptoms very nicely. For those of us who are interested in the toxicity, the dangers of alcohol, it raises some interesting theoretical questions where if someone is a young person who happens to be using a lot of marijuana, it's viewed as a rather innocuous substance, they inadvertently get into this cycle of being tolerant to the drug, dependent on it to the extent when they stop using it, they start experiencing these symptoms. Does this mean they're going to drink more alcohol than they would otherwise, etc.? Now, these are very complicated issues. I simply throw them out as one example of how marijuana interacts with other drugs, with other behaviors, in very complicated ways. that needs to be answered by those proponents who would say, look, it, marijuana is no big deal. It's not like alcohol. It's not like tobacco. Why do you need any regulations? For most users, marijuana is no big deal, to use that term. It's for a subgroup of users. Whether this is 1% or 5% or 10% of users, it's not clear. Most of us have a clinical impression, meaning I can't give you hard numbers, but we have a clinical impression that the number of people who are getting involved and hurt by the drug has increased in recent years. I don't know how it is in Alaska, but one of the to me, continually amazing aspects of marijuana is it's gradually increasing potency. The potency meaning the dose of the drug that's available in a cigarette. When we first started giving marijuana to people years ago, it had what we had in our laboratory, had 1% tetrahydrocannabinol in it. I think it had 10 milligrams in a cigarette. Subjects thought that was pretty good marijuana. Current day marijuana smokers, if we gave them that dose, they would say, this is very weak marijuana. The material that's available to me out in the marketplace is much more potent, much stronger, and in fact it is. If you assay it chemically, you find marijuana now that has 4, 5, 6% THC in it. Now this is doubling, tripling, quadrupling the dose. And so it's not unexpected that a bigger dose of a drug produces more clear-cut and for some users more harmful consequences. But I'm going to go on now to a few comments on specific effects on the nervous system, on the brain. And marijuana is mainly smoked to alter the brain function. It's mainly smoked, and users wouldn't put it this way, but if you look at it somewhat dispassionately as a scientist who's trying to understand brain function, marijuana smoked to impair the functioning of the brain. Now, in its impairing of the brain function, and most psychoactive drugs do this, at least in normal brains, marijuana just happens to produce the relaxed feeling, the perceptual distortion, tendency to be more labile in an emotional state, to lose inhibitions, and so on. But if you look at it in a somewhat cold and calculating way, you're producing what's called an acute brain syndrome. It produces a few hours of abnormal brain function. Now, this abnormal brain function, if you happen to be sitting in your living room watching television or someplace like that, is probably of no great consequence in itself. But if you are in a situation where you must drive an automobile or do something very complicated involving a lot of decision-making, fine motor control, etc., that altered brain function can be a real disaster, both to the individual or to people who are depending on the individual's ability to function. And what I'm saying is that it's quite clear to, I think, everyone who is researching marijuana now, and it has been for some years, that for that 2 or 3 hours after a marijuana cigarette is smoked, there is abnormal functioning of a variety of thinking processes. Memories impaired, reaction times are slowed down, the ability to respond to unexpected events is disturbed. That is, a volunteer is able to drive an automobile reasonably well as long as one is in a predictable situation, say going down a straight road. But if something unexpected happens, something comes in from the periphery, from the side of the automobile, some unexpected action is taken, at least in experimental situations, the person who's intoxicated by marijuana shows precisely the same sort of impairments that one sees from alcohol. Now, experts will quibble as to whether there's more perceptual alterations with the marijuana and less memory than with alcohol, etc. But the important point is that there is quite measurable, quite predictable alterations in brain function. The big question mark that is still unanswered is whether these alterations in brain function last more than the 3 to 4 hours after the intoxication. There's a variety of data, not always well controlled, not perfect in the way it was collected, but an enormous amount of data from all over the world that suggests that with repetitive use with high doses, people do suffer long-lasting adverse consequences. Now, these consequences can range from what's commonly called around here amotivation, that is, a loss of energy, emotional blunting, lack of concern about the future. That's at one end of the continuum. To at the other end, a psychotic state that's very difficult to distinguish from schizophrenia. And in fact, it may never be completely distinguished from schizophrenia because more and more there seems to be an interaction in that certain people who maybe have a certain genetic predisposition to develop schizophrenia may be more sensitive to the effects of cannabis and other drugs. The issue as well, if they never smoked cannabis, if they never smoked marijuana, would they have never developed a psychotic state? Well, this gets to be very difficult to tease out experimentally. But both of the committees that I referred to were impressed with the consistency and the mass of data. That is, you don't draw conclusions about health consequences when someone reports results from 10 subjects, 10 patients that they've seen in their practice. But when you see reports from all over the world, dating back years and years and years, one cannot ignore the consistency. Just this morning, I was down in our library, and a new journal report of a nicely controlled clinical study, not experimental, but reports of 10 patients from a Scandinavian country who were being treated for schizophrenia with adequate treatments, who were doing well clinically, and every time they happened to use some marijuana, their psychoses would return. Now, you know, the argument is, well, okay, people who have schizophrenia certainly shouldn't smoke marijuana, but does that mean one should regulate marijuana? Well, the problem is that it's always not always easy to decide when a given individual has schizophrenia. I cite that as only one fairly common disease. It's not a rare disease. And the issue that falls on your shoulders is, well, what do you do about protecting those people through regulatory schemes? And that's the issue you have to deal with. That it's quite clear that if one is smokes marijuana under ideal situations, i.e. you do it all by yourself, there's nobody else around you, you don't try to drive an automobile or program a computer or make a complicated decision, you know, even perhaps at the level of should I have sex without contraceptives, etc. You know, under the ideal circumstances, probably most people can get away with smoking marijuana and not pay any more of a price in terms of health consequences than drinking a beer or two under similar circumstances. But at the other end of the decision-making equation, clearly people who are using marijuana, some of them are running the same risks that people who are using beer run. That is, some of them are going to become analogous to alcoholics. Some of them are going to get into situations from marijuana intoxication quite analogous to alcohol intoxication. Now, the issue always comes up there, well, we don't have regulatory schemes, which we're not talking about prohibiting alcohol. Well, I think alcohol is such a part of our culture that would be very difficult now to prohibit it. I, as a medical scientist, I think we would save a great deal of health consequences if we did. I don't think marijuana, at least in our part of the United States, is quite as part of the culture as alcohol is. That I sense we're having more and more trouble recruiting subjects who are frequent, heavy, daily marijuana users because a lot of people are, marijuana is disappearing as an important part of their lives. I don't have any hard data on it. I've seen statistics from our National Institute on Drug Abuse, but it suggests that saying the prohibition of marijuana is exactly analogous to trying to prohibit alcohol or, for that matter, tobacco, this isn't necessarily the same situation. Marijuana just isn't part of our culture in the way that others are. The one system, and I'm going to move from the brain into less emotionally charged organs, the one system that marijuana clearly has adverse effects on that you can measure that nobody disagrees on is on the left on the respiratory system, that clearly if one smokes marijuana, inhales it, and that's about the only way people smoke it. If you do it enough, long enough, you get all the sort of cellular changes and lung function changes that you get from smoking tobacco. Now, there's a lot of sort of experts quibbling amongst themselves. Is marijuana relatively more toxic than tobacco smoke? The equations of, you know, how many marijuana cigarettes equal how many tobacco cigarettes, these aren't completely worked out. But certainly I and my colleagues on these two committees, I think, have no problems in concluding that if you're smoking marijuana cigarettes, you're damaging your lungs. Now, the issue there comes up, well, we don't pass legislation against tobacco. I think any prudent person, if we knew at the time, if we know what we know now about tobacco and health hazards, that tobacco would not be merchandised over the counter. We still have regulatory schemes to try to keep young people from using tobacco. These don't work very well here. But on the other hand, I think they serve a certain purpose of at least communicating a message to them. So. Now, when you move from the lung to the to the cardiovascular system, that is the heart, things are a bit more speculative. Certainly, marijuana's effects on the cardiovascular system, on heart function, are very prominent. They're quite predictable. They're probably of very little consequence in a normal, healthy individual. But both experimentally and logically, that if one is has compromised cardiac function, say angina, a propensity to perhaps a coronary occlusion, that the effects of marijuana are precisely those that you would expect to make the difference and move someone from a borderline cardiac functioning into someone who is in failure, etc. The data on this is most unsatisfactory because most people who smoke most marijuana most of the time are young people. They're not in the high-risk group for cardiovascular effects. It's interesting to us in my laboratory, where we're doing a great deal of tobacco and nicotine research, where the magnitude of the cardiovascular effects, that is the amount of them from marijuana, at least as much, perhaps more than it is with tobacco. And it's an interesting parallel there, where nicotine and tobacco, though it speeds up heart rate, it raises blood pressure, you don't see any long-term consequences till you've used tobacco for 20 years or so. And then in tobacco users, you clearly see an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, probably related as much to the nicotine as it is to the material in the smoke. Some of us wonder whether if you could follow a group of regular marijuana smokers for 20 years, would you see the same long-term effects? This is speculation, but it's quite possible in terms of mechanism. There's been a lot of discussion in the lay press about the carcinogenicity, the mutations that marijuana or THC can induce. That is marijuana carcinogenic? It's a confusing issue in that clearly in animals and in test tube preparations, that is cultures of tissues growing, bacteria growing, that cannabis, marijuana, and many of the things in it are both mutagenic and carcinogenic. They alter the chemistry of the nucleic acids, building blocks of many of our cells. The disagreement amongst experts is, well, so this happens in animals, and so it happens in test tubes. Does it happen in humans? It's very difficult to demonstrate such things happen in humans. I'm continually amused and somewhat distressed at the same time in, for example, the concern over the PCBs and other toxic chemicals in our environment, and what amounts to almost hysteria in terms of a public response to a small leak of PCBs. Well, the data that many of these cannabinoids in marijuana, the data as to their carcinogenic effects are just about as good as the data for some of these other be ignored. I know of no cases where marijuana has produced cancer. I know of no studies where more cancer is seen in marijuana users. But if you look at the test tube data, if you look at the animal data, one has to accept that there is this potential there. And there's a similar sort of potential with the so-called immune system, that in animal studies and in test tube studies, materials in marijuana have what one would have to term a mild, transient immunosuppressant effect. This has not been demonstrated clearly in humans. And the issue is, well, if there's a weak effect on the immune system, and you're talking about populations of millions of users, is this a public health consequence or not? That is, do you see additive effects where marijuana is one event in a whole chain of things? How do you assess the importance of this? And you see, these are very complicated issues. Similar issues come up around the effects of marijuana on the fetus. Clearly, at high doses in some species of animals, not all species, cannabis is clearly teratogenic. That is, it makes for abnormal fetal development. But the problem with assessing the health consequences, this is true of lots of drugs. It's true of caffeine at high doses, for example. You know, we somehow accept caffeine as being part of our life. To my knowledge, there's no evidence of obvious teratogenicity in humans, that is, deformed infants being born of marijuana users. There's a few reports of it, but people, particularly women who use a lot of marijuana, tend to have dietary differences. They use other drugs, so it's hard to pin it down to marijuana. There's one series of studies from Canadian investigators that are quite well controlled. What you find is that the offspring of mothers who use cannabis during pregnancy showed for some months after birth increased startle responses. They were more irritable. They had strange tremors. Their cries were thought to be a bit unusual. Now, the question is whether this was completely due to the marijuana or due to other differences in these women who are using a lot of marijuana. Well, they tried to tease out those variables. The other issue is, well, these are temporary things. That we know in a woman who is smoking marijuana, there's very high levels of THC going through the fetus. Are these just temporary adjustments? Well, I think the issue is that most prudent obstetricians would recommend that no woman who's pregnant use any drug for that matter. And is it the province of legislators to regulate the availability of a drug to deal with that sort of issue? I can only tell you that, you know, clearly marijuana gets into the fetus. In the animal fetus, it produces abnormalities. In at least one good study, it produced some behavioral abnormalities in the newborn, and that's about where we are there. There are many other effects of marijuana on the reproductive system. Virtually all the sex hormones can be altered in complicated ways, both in animals and in human studies. It doesn't always come out that way, but it's a complicated system in the body. Now, whether altering testosterone levels or altering female hormone levels have any particular health consequences, one can only speculate about. But there are powerful changes go on. If you're an optimist, you believe these are temporary changes. If you're a pessimist around the drug, you say these may have a hard to recognize effects. Finally, I'll comment on just two last things, the complicated issue of drug interactions. Cannabis, for a variety of chemical reasons, interacts, that is, alters the effects, alters the metabolism of a variety of other drugs. Drugs that we and others have shown, alcohol, barbiturates, nicotine, amphetamines, cocaine, PCP, opiates, all these drugs are altered by the presence of marijuana. Now, in some situations, it enhances the effects of the drug. In other situations, it diminishes some of the other effects of the drug. The interactions are very complicated. It has to do with liver. drinking alcohol as well, and you get into rather complicated predictions. Finally, the issue of therapeutic uses of cannabis. There's been a lot of attention paid to this. A lot of effort has gone into trying to develop, to try to define therapeutic applications of either marijuana or some of the substances in marijuana. It remains an open area in the extent that it's still clear that the THC and the things in marijuana represent a class of drugs that are really quite unique in their pharmacology and maybe would have some therapeutic applications. However, thus far, it's been a bit disappointing in that in most all the instances where marijuana has been touted as some kind of therapeutic breakthrough, particularly in, for example, controlling the nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy or controlling certain cases of glaucoma, elevated eye pressure. These, you know, therapeutic breakthroughs have turned out to be modest at best. Other agents are available, generally work as well, and one of the serious limiting factors with the cannabinoids is that they produce psychoactive effects, where if you are someone with glaucoma who does not happen to be a marijuana enthusiast, you tend to view these psychoactive effects on brain function as being something you don't want to experience. You just want to get your eye pressure dropped, and you don't want to be dizzy, and you don't want to be high, etc. And it's a similar problem with using it in chemotherapy for the nausea and vomiting, that younger patients who happen to be somewhat prone to appreciate the effects of marijuana get much better results than the middle-aged or elderly patients who are really quite disturbed by the effects of the drug. But the point is that research should go on and must go on in terms of therapeutic applications, but there's no hard and fast conclusions available, and I doubt that there will soon be hard and fast conclusions available. The real potential will be synthetic drugs that have characteristics like some of the things in marijuana, not marijuana itself. Certainly my experience has been that it's possible to write good legislation making marijuana available for those situations where therapeutic trials are indicated. It should be good science. You know, the dispensing of marijuana for treating this and that is not going to serve anyone's needs well over the long run. And I think at least in California, the federal regulatory schemes are working reasonably well in that respect. Well, I've gone on far longer than I really had intended to. I think I've said pretty much what I had thought about saying, and if there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to.
Well, Doctor, we certainly thank you for your comments. The situation, as you know, we have it here, is that they have, in fact, liberalized a small quantity. In other words, it's not illegal in Alaska at the present time to have up to 4 ounces of this in your possession. In fact, it's not even legal under Alaskan law to have 1 ounce of it with you while you're walking around. We have a different situation than all other states have. We're kind of admonished by those in the Department of Law and others that if we are to reverse this decision, the preponderance of evidence that we gather prior to taking legislative action must be somewhat overwhelming, and that's the reason for bringing persons such as yourself at least onto the record.
Just let me add my opinion that 4 ounces may, by some criteria, be a small amount of marijuana. On the other hand, it's enough to keep a person continually intoxicated for 200 or 300 hours. And I don't know how you judge that. If you consider how much alcohol you would need to keep yourself intoxicated for a similar period of time. So, you know, by some metric, 4 ounces is a rather large amount of marijuana, particularly if it's the very potent marijuana that I refer to.
Well, during your comments, sir, you talked about the brain retaining this. Perhaps, can you expand on that a little for some guy like me that's sitting here to listen to that? What does it mean the brain retains it? Does it damage the brain when it's there? And does
that's the important question. That what I mean when I say the brain retains it is that it's the nature of THC and other things in marijuana to very preferentially go into brain tissue. That is, any tissue that has a lot of fat in it. It goes there and stays and is relatively slowly removed from it. And the issue that there's absolutely no good data on, either in animals or in humans, is that we know these metabolites are in the brain for long periods of time. Does that mean they're going to be more dangerous and more harmful? Perhaps one way of trying to clarify is give you an analogy with alcohol. You get intoxicated, your brain levels of alcohol are precisely the same as your blood levels of alcohol. But after 8-10 hours, after the hangover is over, there's no alcohol left in your brain. Okay, and whatever damage was done while the alcohol went there and left. Well, someone who smokes a marijuana cigarette, they're obviously intoxicated. You can measure this quite easily for 2 or 3 hours after the smoking the marijuana cigarette. But instead of, like with alcohol, the marijuana going, the brain levels at 3 or 4 hours or even the next morning are almost as high as they were when they smoked the marijuana cigarette. Now, you know, this may or may not be important, but it's a difference that troubles some experts in this field, saying it's an ideal situation where even if the toxicity of marijuana is relatively low, it's sitting there for long periods of time, and you can see, you know, cumulative effects. It's a very important difference between marijuana and alcohol for those who want to try to make that sort of comparison.
Doctor, perhaps I can ask you one more question, and then other committee members have questions. If you were presented with the same degree of information about the possible harmful effects of aspirin, and you were in a position to do so, would you remove aspirin from the market?
Oh, that's a tough one to answer. I think I would try to have some sort of control over it. See, aspirin's a bad example, in a way, in that it's something that has been around. I think if aspirin came onto the market, it was a brand new drug that we didn't know about, and we knew that some rare individuals, you know, simply died from a small dose of aspirin under very unusual situations. Others quite predictably developed bleeding disorders and other things. I think there might have been more regulatory schemes associated with controlling aspirin than we actually have. But remember, aspirin has been around long enough that even though we know there's a lot of toxicity, we also know that on average it has a lot to offer.
Well, I was trying to paint the same kind of a scenario that you might have.
Yeah, perhaps I could give you a slightly different example. I serve on a Food and Drug Administration committee that reviews some of the toxic issues that are reviewed just prior to a drug moving from its experimental phase into being marketed. And we recently have reviewed a number of drugs that are being issued as therapeutic drugs, not mostly as prescription drugs. And I'm quite certain that the conclusion of our committee would be that there's still enough unknown about marijuana, and there are these questions as to some of the health hazards, like the significance of brain levels, that are unanswered, such that the manufacturer will probably be told to go back and collect more data before we market it. That if we were treating marijuana like a prescription drug, I don't think it would reach the market, particularly if the market was viewed as tens of thousands of people using it at a variety of dose levels.
Thank you, sir. That's what I was after. I was thinking more or less of something like saccharin or sugars or something that are out and they've been pulled off the market because of tests that have shown that there's a possibility that they could cause things.
It's very difficult to go back when a drug becomes sort of accepted and part of our life. I guess it's just against human nature. And I think that's one of the arguments with marijuana that different experts will disagree on is, is it really that part of our life? Is it more like sugar and aspirin and alcohol, or is it something less ingrained, less established than that? And I, on the basis of relatively little hard data, but more just my clinical sense, I don't think it is quite as established as is aspirin and alcohol, et cetera, that you hear a lot of vocal, a lot of pressure is brought whenever talk is raised about somehow limiting its availability. But I sense in recent years less and less organized pressure. Most of the recent surveys I've seen, more and more even young users, potential users, are raising serious questions about its side effects, bad consequences. I think it's something one just has to use a certain intuitive sense to judge, in a sense.
Thank you, Doctor. We have another committee here, member here representing Winty, would like to ask you some questions, sir.
All right.
Thank you, Doctor. I do hazard to ask a question since I just took some aspirin before I started the meeting, but with the chairman's
great
permission.
Drug. I did too. go ahead.
You have cautioned us about going to experts on this subject. Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Gabriel G. Nahas at Columbia? And if you are, would you characterize his standing in the field?
Well, I'm quite familiar with his work and know him well. He's been a bit of a controversial figure in the field in that long before it became fashionable and popular to raise questions about possible adverse effects, Dr. Nahas has been, I think, a consistent, outspoken, and I would use the term dedicated, person representing the position there's a lot we don't know about marijuana that there's cause for concern. Complacency certainly is not the position to take. His findings, I think it's fair to say, are controversial. He would disagree with me, I know, and we've discussed this. On the other hand, I think his findings cannot be ignored. And he has worked in this very complicated area of trying to measure effects inside of cells using tissue cultures and looking at, you know, test tube preparations. It's easy to criticize these experiments as being irrelevant to what goes on in human beings, that the doses he's using are too high, that things are different in animals than they are in humans, etc. On the other hand, you can't dismiss it completely, you say. And I know he is considered to be less controversial now, and his position is less unpopular than it was, say, 10 years ago when he first held it. I think he represents a position that cannot be ignored. And he's a true believer to the extent that he will exaggerate the position that makes his case and tend to ignore inconsistent data. On the other hand, he's not a bad scientist.
I must admit, Doctor, that we do intend to take his testimony following yours, and I tend to ask him the same question about you.
Nahas will give you a far more consistent, less middle-of-the-road position that I have been trying to give you. And I think that's the nature of the debate over marijuana, and it still is, you know, still is an unsettled area. So I'm pleased to hear that you're going to get some information from Dr. Nahas.
Thank you, sir.
In fact, someone has just handed me a note that said it's 7 o'clock in New York City, and the doctor would like us to call him now, so...
if you do, when you do, tell him that Jones has taken far more time than he should have, because Nahas has a reputation of talking too much, and he sometimes, he and I josh each other about that.
Maybe I'll try to kid him and say you tried to take up his time.
Right, exactly.
Well... Dr. Jones, we certainly thank you. I hate to cut off any more questions, but we do need to do that. And with your permission, sir, we'd like to at least to have the ability to contact you at a later date for either some further comment or some questions that may develop as a result of your comments.
By all means, do so. I hope that I've been able to... You're engaged in a very complicated undertaking. I hope I've been able to help a little bit.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right. I wish you well.
Have a good day.
All right. Bye.
Dr. Nahas?
Yes.
Yes, I'm Charlie Bussell, and I am chairman of the House Judiciary Committee in Juneau.
How do you do?
We have finished talking with Dr. Jones, who asked me to pass on his greetings to you and say he tried to take up your time. He thought his testimony would probably overshadow yours anyway. He thought that would be a joke. I added to that a little bit. But he did ask me to pass along his greetings to you. And sir,
yes, thank you.
And
he didn't
know the threat. That's what he said. He tried to stretch it out. Sir, I need to advise you before we start that the committee's hearings are recorded electronically, and they're made a permanent part of the record. And I need to state just prior to your statement that we are debating House Bill 698, which is an act relating to marijuana. And I believe the staff has explained to you somewhat of the situation with marijuana and the amount that's legal here and what we're trying to do with the record, have they not?
Yes.
Very good, sir. So everyone in the room can hear you quite well here. And at this time, sir, if you'd like to proceed with your statement, we would be more than happy to take it.
My name is Gabriel Nas. I'm an MD and a PhD. I'm professor of anesthesiology at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and adjunct professor at the University of Paris. I'm also a consultant to the United Nations Commission on Narcotics and a lecturer of the United States Information Service on matters of drug abuse. I'm a member of the American, British, and French Pharmacological Societies. Pharmacology is my profession. I'm the author of 500 research papers in the field of pharmacology, 100 of them on marijuana. I have been chairman and organizer of three major symposia on the biological effect of marijuana. One in 1975, the second in 1978, and the third one will take place in Oxford next summer. Those three symposia were organized under the aegis of the International Pharmacological Society. My interest of marijuana stems from my interest in the field of pharmacology, and especially in the study of new substances. I would like to summarize rapidly the main effects of marijuana on biological system, experimental as well as clinical. First, I'd like to speak a little about the pharmacological basic fundamental aspects of the problem. It's been shown that the extracts and smoke condensates of marijuana are mutagenic in the in vitro ape test. This means that they produce permanent changes in the genetic endowment of the cell. It's been shown that most substances which are mutagenic are also cancer-producing. Such tests have been reproduced also in animals in vivo, which show after treatment with marijuana a large incidence of abnormal cells in bone marrow as well as abnormal sperm cells. While cannabinoids, that's to say the substance proper to the cannabis plant, do not produce seemingly chromosome breaks, they act as what are called mitotic disruptors. That's to say, they impair the proper segregation of chromosomes during cell division. We have shown here at Columbia University in our laboratory that all cannabinoids, that is the substances specific to the cannabis plant, are going to impair in very small concentration, micromolar concentration, the production of nucleic acids and proteins. These substances are essential for proper division of cells. It's also been shown by others that marijuana smoke is carcinogenic in vitro, to say it produces cancer. And cannabis tar,
a blood on the skin is cancer-producing in the rat. As a matter of fact, there is about 50% more cancer-producing substances in a marijuana cigarette of the same weight as a tobacco cigarette. Therefore, it's not surprising that marijuana smoking is irritating to the lung and produces in man symptoms of airway obstruction in spite of the effect of bronchodilation of THC. Marijuana also decreases the power of white cells in the lung, which protect against bacteria or toxic substances. And as reported in the World Health Organization report in 1982, respiratory and pulmonary toxicity has emerged as major clinical implication of chronic cannabis smoking. Furthermore, the increased heart rate produced by cannabis makes its use hazardous in patients with cardiac disease. Exposure to cannabis in rodents, rats, causes a reduced rate of body gain. The exposure of all experimental animals to cannabis results in symptoms of brain toxicity, which are characterized by residual impairment, such as a long-lasting impairment in learning, brainwave changes, biochemical alteration in brain chemistry, and impairment in the ability of the animal to exhibit appropriate adaptive behavior. In man, the neurobehavioral toxicity of long-term cannabis use is manifested in some heavy smokers by impaired motivation and impaired ability to perform complex tasks. The extent of this negative response to cannabis of the brain appears to be more pronounced at two critical stages of brain development. In the newborn, exposed to marijuana during his intrauterine life, and in the adolescent, when all the neuroendocrine and affective functions and structures of the brain are in the process of integration. In experimental animals, cannabis exposure has been associated with disruptive effects on all phases of reproductive function. This is due to a direct effect of marijuana on a part of the brain, the hypothalamus, which controls the production of sexual hormones, and it's also due to a direct effect of marijuana product on the sexual glands. In the male, cannabis induces decreased testicular size and spermatogenesis, and lower hormones, lower of prolactin and testosterone plasma concentration. This is in the animal. In the non-humane human female primate, THC acutely inhibits the hormones which are essential for the proper programmation of the menstrual cycle, and therefore they disrupt ovarian cycle and ovulation. Tolerance to these effects of marijuana do develop. That's to say that after several months, menstrual cycle will reappear normally. In man, marijuana smoking has been associated with decreased sperm formation and increased incidence of abnormal sperm cells. These observations were made here at Columbia University in a program where I was a principal investigator. In women smoking marijuana, a disruption of the menstrual cycles has been reported. Marijuana is also dangerous for the growing fetus. Indeed, the cannabinoids cross the placental barrier and are transferred to maternal milk. Experimental studies indicate that the negative effects of marijuana on the development of the egg and the fetus may be caused by even preconception exposure with resulting damage to the gametes, either sperm or egg. These negative developmental effects are also observed following prenatal exposure to cannabis with resulting damage to the embryo or fetus. Finally, postnatal exposure to maternal milk will result also in damage to the growing offspring. These observations are not only limited to many of the animal species where experiments have been performed. Let's say rats, rabbits, and primates. Indeed, a recent report indicates that compared with non-users, women who used marijuana during pregnancy delivered infants who were smaller. They were 1 pound less in weight and were 5 times more likely to have facial features, compatible with the so-called fetal alcohol syndrome. They had 5 times the risk of being disfigured. Finally, THC and cannabis extract do inhibit in rodents the primary immune response. That's to say, the ability of an animal to respond to an attack against the immunity system. Cannabis also impairs in animals the resistance of the animal to the propagation of a virus of herpes simplex. In man at present, there is suggestive but not conclusive evidence that consumption of marijuana may produce an immunodepression. The after the most prominent effect of marijuana is to impair the ability of an individual to interpret in a proper fashion his external environment. Cannabis intoxication disrupts psychomotor function as measured by coordination, reaction time, tracking, sensory, and perceptual functions. Acute marijuana intoxication also impairs intellectual and cognitive functions as determined by tests measuring learning, memory, time sense, and oral communication. The impairment of memory storage has been well documented. All of these acute effects of marijuana are the result of acute, reversible toxicity of the drug on the brain. Driving skills and performance are impaired by cannabis, and now it's established that it's dangerous for others and for oneself to drive under the influence of marijuana intoxication. Marijuana will also interact with other commonly used licit and illicit drugs. It increases the depressant effect of psychodepressants like alcohol, sedatives, and opiates. And it also interacts with the stimulants, with additive and antagonistic effect occurring depending upon dose and time intervals between ingestions. A mark in rapid tolerance to most of the physical and psychological effects of marijuana develop in animal and man. That's to say, it's necessary to increase dosage in order to obtain initial effects. This tolerance has both a metabolic and a tissue component, but it may not be developed to some of the non-specific cellular damaging effect of the drug. Withdrawal symptoms do develop after cessation of heavy daily cannabis administration, and these symptoms are more marked following pure THC administration, as shown by Rees-Jones. Therefore, cannabis could be classified among the dependence-producing drugs, which have the following characteristics. They induce symptoms of reversible toxicity to the brain and impairment of sound and coherent behavior. They induce a primary pleasurable reward and dissipate unpleasant feelings, and it's the main reason why they're used. They act as a reinforcer, that's to say they induce a marked craving for the drug, drug-oriented behavior, in order to obtain enough supply of the drug. They induce tolerance. The abrupt interruption of this drug is associated with some withdrawal symptoms, as shown by Rees-Jones. Long-term use is associated with increased incidence of mental illness, and this, I think, is a very serious feature of marijuana. Indeed, marijuana is one of the few drugs with alcohol and barbiturates which have been associated after prolonged chronic use to a serious mental illness. This association has been recorded throughout the ages since about 2,000 years ago and in hundreds of papers. Such an association has never been reported between the use of opiates, after the use of opiates, which are certainly drugs as commonly used as cannabis for assistance. The first mental disturbance which has been reported are paranoid reactions, which are transitory. However, the associated anxiety may occasionally deepen into a panic state, and acute episodes of delusion and hallucinations do occur. Besides giving rise to acute and transient mental disturbances, cannabis can produce flashbacks. Such adverse mental reactions raise the question of the long-term potential of the drug to induce severe mental illness. Cannabis use may trigger an underlying psychosis, such as schizophrenia. Such episodes have occurred in subjects who had already suffered from the disease and presented a relapse after using cannabis. Dr. Negrete in Montreal and Dr. Irons in Jamaica have reported recently such cases. Cannabis is therefore contraindicated for unstable personalities, since psychotic episodes in some subjects only develop for the first time after exposure to the drug. The long daily high dosage exposure to cannabis among adolescents and young adults has been associated in the United States with an amotivational syndrome, which was described throughout the ages among chronic cannabis users. Also called burnout by high school students, it is characterized by loss of interest and initiative, mental and physical deterioration, and social stagnation. It has been described over the centuries in India and Africa. The question as to whether cannabis usage per se produces long-term psychotic episodes is still debated. Difficulties in establishing causality in absence of a biological marker are very large. One never knows which comes first, the chicken or the egg. That's true for this manifestation of cannabis. Cannabis intoxication has most serious effects, and this, I think, should be emphasized in adolescents and children. 8 to 18 years old, who are attempted to structure their personalities when their vulnerable brain is in the process of integration. The available evidence on the negative impact of cannabis on mental health is not reassuring and should certainly be a matter of serious concern. All available evidence also indicate that regular cannabis consumption is associated in developed countries where other drugs are available with multiple drug use, including opiate derivatives like heroin, cocaine, and other more dangerous substances. My colleague Ken Doyle at Columbia University has reported that 26% of daily users of marijuana in high school went on to experiment with these other addictive drugs. I think this is a summary, to the best of my knowledge, of the untoward effect of marijuana use. I would be glad to answer your questions.
Doctor, we thank you very much for your statement. It came through well. Dr. Jones brought something up that was interesting to me. He said that when they started testing marijuana some time ago, that the levels, and if I'm trying to get this right, I'm not all that familiar with it, but the levels of THC in a joint were at rather low levels, down somewhere around 1% or less, and today that joint wouldn't be perceived as much of a joint by those who used it, that it was now much higher, up into sometimes 4 or 5%. Does that hold true with what you feel or found?
Certainly. Well, this is not the way I feel. These are the reports from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, which performs regularly analysis of seizures of cannabis preparations, and also analysis of the Sensimilla, which is now grown in California and Oregon. The THC content of these flowering tops of cannabis are in the order of 6 to 8%.
Is that due to better breeding on the part of the growers? Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Well, there are, you know, modern technology allows for excellent selection of seeds, and also methods which allow maximum concentration of the intoxicating substance in the flowering top by certain procedures, such as eliminating all the male plants so that there is more inflorescence in the female plant. But mostly it's proper selection of the seed. Most of these seeds come from Thailand, as a matter of fact.
Okay, what I was trying to lead to in my own mind, Doctor, was you know about our law here, how it, in 1975 it got changed, allowing, right at the moment, it's not against the law, for instance, for someone to hold or have 4 ounces of marijuana in his possession, or in his home, which in effect is in his possession. If that happened in 1975, if 4 ounces in 75 would be considered safe at those lower levels, which I seriously question anyway, why that 4 ounces today would change considerably, would it not?
Oh, it certainly would. As a matter of fact, the international legislation, which Alaska is now breaking, since the single convention requires all parties to the convention, including the United States, to restrict the use of marijuana to scientific and medical purpose, and requires the parties to penalize use in possession of any amount, as a matter of fact. So, and this treaty was actually pushed and sponsored by the producing nations of the Far East, where the preparation contains high THC levels and have shown to be in those countries damaging to the people and to their society.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more, Doctor, but we're faced with
something. Alaska is now you're using in Alaska probably preparation which are certainly much more toxic and dangerous to the development of young people than they were 10 years ago.
Yes, you see, we're faced with somewhat of a dilemma as legislators. We're trying to look at trying to change this, and I'm trying to meet with an admonishment from those who have to enforce any change, with accumulating a high enough degree of evidence so that they will be able to enforce that should they have to